Oh, Patrick, so good to see you. He was like a stranger. I said, shit. We're not going to own La Tour des Agents.
With all of this percolating, Puck commented to Lazaroff one afternoon at her apartment that he longed to have his own restaurant, something like you see in the south of France, in particular, Chez Goetfi, where he used to enjoy those Sunday afternoons in his Les Beaux du Provence days. But you probably couldn't have a pizza oven, he sighed, resignedly. Lazaroff picked up the phone, dialed the fire department, asked to speak to an inspector.
We're thinking of doing a restaurant, and we want to put a wood-burning oven in it, she told him. And we want to make pizzas in the wood-burning oven.
The inspector asked if customers could come into contact with the oven. She assured him that there'd be a counter to act as barrier. It sounds okay, lady. That was enough for Lazaroff. She and Puck began conceiving their restaurant, a casual pizza joint, both feeling a longing to replicate the magic of Chez Goetfi and to fill a void in the burgeoning L.A. dining scene. He initially envisioned a by-the-numbers joint, with red-checkered tablecloths and candles stuffed into straw-wrapped Chianti bottles. Puck was also spurred by a visit to Bertrenoux, his head swollen in the full throes of his brain tumor, at his hospital bedside.
I used to bring him the duck salad, says Puck. I said, Jean, look what I'm doing at Ma Maison now. And he said, you should open your own restaurant.
He said,
get away from this guy. He's not good. Open your own restaurant.
Puck and Lazaroff went through a few possible partners. Seattle Supersonics owner Sam Shulman came and went, followed by composer Giorgio Moroder, known for his synth-heavy 1980s defining soundtracks to Midnight Express and American Gigolo, who suggested the name Spago, but they couldn't come to terms. According to Puck, Moroder wanted 60% or 70% of the profits in perpetuity, instead of a more standard 65-35 model that would flip once he recouped his investment. The solution presented itself in the same place where Puck and Lazaroff began their courtship, Ma Cuisine. Donald Salk, a dentist from Chicago and fledgling food enthusiast on his second marriage, was a frequent student there. It was easier to score a spot in the classes than a table at Ma Maison. In fact, Salk had never dined there, and cheaper too. So Salk became a regular and bonded with Puck, who confided his discontent and desire to open what he was still describing as a pizza place. Salk offered to help him raise money, although his wife, an L.A. native, told him he was crazy. But Salk was turned on by the idea of owning a restaurant, or even just part of one. He connected with Michael Roberts' attorney, devised a limited partnership concept, began going after 34 investors at $15,000 a pop. To entice them, Puck hosted brunches and Salk wined and dined them at Ma Maison. Despite the love for Puck, there were fundraising challenges. In time, Spago would become a shining restaurant on a hill, but its predecessor in the space, Kavkez, was anything but, a Russian-Armenian restaurant overlooking a hooker-rich Sunset Boulevard. Memories differ on the final number of investors. The consensus puts it in the mid-20s. Down the homestretch, Puck and Salk put their houses up as collateral to surmount a funding gap. They raised a total of $510,000, which Puck supplemented with an equipment loan. It was barely enough. I had $10,000 or $12,000 left, and I put it in three different banks, and wrote checks on all of them, Puck said, the intention being to give the impression he had more money than he did. With the financing in place, Puck says he approached Tarai.
I said, I found this location up there. We're going to do this Italian bistro. There's only one condition. We have to form a 50-50 partnership, and we have to spruce up Ma Maison to get it a little more luxurious, not to have astroturf and plastic chairs. And he looked at me after a second and said, you know, I will always own 51%. I will never do 50-50. So I said, me too.
Puck realized that it was time to leave. He gave Tarai 3 months' notice, but after 2 weeks, people were openly gossiping. Unsurprisingly, Tarai recalls a different version of events, insisting that he would have taken a 50-50 split on both restaurants, the new venture and Ma Maison, but that Lazaroff, not Puck, did the negotiating. that he was turned off by the fact that she would be running the new place, and that she invited him to invest in the new restaurant, not be a partner. He also says that he learned about Puck's plans, including the name Spago, when he phoned his office from vacation, and his assistant told him it was in The Hollywood Reporter. She also told Tarai that television producer Bob Stivers, of Circus of the Star success, had been trying to help Puck and Lazaroff, bringing a steady parade of potential investors, mostly dentists and doctors, to Ma Maison for lunch while Tarai was overseas.
I come back and obviously I'm a little furious, says Tarai. Probably short-tempered, probably came to some rash decision. But I guess I was young, egocentric and everything that goes with that. And I probably said, absolutely not. I can't do both.
The ensuing breakup was, says Puck, like a bad divorce. Tarai cut Puck's access to company assets. One morning, he woke up to find the company car missing. He went to the store to buy supplies, and the cashier confiscated his credit card, cut it in half. Puck retaliated in his own way. Cat Stevens used to come to the restaurant all the time, and he used to eat soft-boiled eggs. Patrick comes into the kitchen ranting and raving, I need soft-boiled eggs for Cat Stevens. Finally, I took a ladle out of the eggs and said, You want the eggs? Here they are. And bang! The eggs were on the wall, and he had the egg yolks and everything on him. Puck had become a bit of a known quantity since his first days at Ma Maison, but when he cut the cord with Tarai, he was overcome with self-doubt. I was so nervous, I put on 25 pounds, he said. It didn't help that Tarai, his L.A. papa, was, according to Puck, telling anyone who'd listen that he was a bad manager.
It was a terrible time, Puck said. There was no recipe.
Puck and Salk made a visit to Chez Panisse, where Puck connected with his old cook Mark Peel, told him about his new concept, which he was still describing, despite Lazaroff's protestations, as a pizza place that was also going to serve pasta and salads. He painted Peel a picture that would have horrified former set decorator Lazaroff, checkered tablecloths, candles stuck in Chianti bottles, a guitar player on Saturday nights. Because Puck wishfully thought he'd do Spago without leaving Ma Maison, he asked Peel to become the chef of Spago. Peel returned to Los Angeles, took a job back at Michael's to pay the rent for the months when Spago was being built. Before he left Berkeley, Peel obtained the name and number of the contractor who'd built Chez Panisse's oven, a German, and persuaded the man to move to Los Angeles, where he parked his rig at the construction site, living there and insisting on being paid in cash. He built the oven, but also drank too much, had temper tantrums, fired people. One day, Salk received a panic call from Lazaroff. The contractor was going to walk if he didn't receive $100 immediately. Salk rushed over, cash in hand, handed it to Puck, who passed it up a ladder to the man. Lazaroff fibbed to the Board of Health, telling them it was a fireplace, which was more true than she knew.
We found out later that he built them rather badly, says Peel. He built them like a fireplace. They were really inefficient when it came to burning our wood.
Lazaroff brought all of her design capabilities to bear in creating a space like no other, with wire chairs and what she called an exhibition kitchen. Spago came together crazy fast. When it was ready to go, there was no waiting. Peel departed Michaels, as did Nancy Silverton, with whom he had coupled up and would eventually marry, then divorce, who signed on as pastry chef. Silverton didn't leave Michaels lightly, because it was established.
None of us went to Spago because it was Spago, she says.
To seal the deal, Peel pulled an all-nighter, pleading his case to Silverton's mother, earning her blessing. As the restaurant came to life, Puck, who'd gradually been migrating further and further away from traditional cuisine, decided he wanted the cooks to reflect the changing times. If they were going to be visible to customers, he didn't want them to look formal, staid, the way they did in, say, Soltner's kitchen at Lutèce in New York City.
I said, we're going to make baseball caps. White baseball caps with the word Spago on it, in our color, the pinkish color. The cooks loved it. Everybody loved it. Then it became a fad all over. It didn't make it so starchy.
The same impulse led Puck to design his own menu, to avoid the formality of a leather-bound tome. David Hockney had designed Mamaison's menu, but Puck couldn't afford him or his peers. So he drew a collage of images depicting casual dishes and scribbled the phrase California cuisine on the cover. The dishes weren't exact templates of what would be served, and that was fine by Puck, who intended the images as a blueprint. When we started, I said, "We're not going to have a big menu," says Puck. "We'll change it as much as we can, whatever we get." So we had like 6 appetizers, a few pizzas, and grilled and roasted food. It was very simple. The day before opening, Peel began prepping at 10 in the morning and worked straight through the night, all the way up until the doors opened. Puck put off writing the menu, a major production in the pre-computer/pre-email era, requiring typing, proofing, printing, and laminating. One day he just sat down at this crappy little desk we had downstairs, 4 sheets of paper, and wrote the menu, in pen. No crossouts, no erasing, nothing, remembers Peel, who was allowed 1 menu item. He scribbled a Chez Panisse golden oldie, angel hair pasta with goat cheese and broccoli, in the margin. "I like it that way," says Puck. "I like the pressure, and in a way, I like the surprise." Construction continued until the last possible second as well. Says Peel, "They hammered the last nail at 4. We opened the doors at 6. There were no dry runs, no practice services, known today as friends and family dinners. The kitchen team hadn't cooked the menu a single time before opening. We cooked the first night with the menus propped in front of us, so at least we could remember to get all the listed ingredients into the dishes, says Peel. There was no recipe, remembers Kazuto Matsusaka, another Mamaison alum who joined Puck at Spago. I went up to Wolfgang. How do you make this tuna sashimi salad? Wolf goes, cut it up. Just make it up. Just make it whatever you think is good. That's how it was. It felt like being at a party all the time. Spago opened on January 16, 1982. Puck was so insecure that he told Salk to invite his wife's enormous extended family to ensure a somewhat full house. But when the dentist and his family arrived, they were confronted with 18 Rolls Royces in the parking lot and had to wait hours for a table. The restaurant did 170 covers that night. When the doors first opened, remembers Lazaroff, I was still shoeless standing on top of the kitchen counter, getting the track lights correct. I thought of it as a stage. I used to study theater lighting and design. That's what I did. So I said, that's my star. These are my stars. I'm lighting them up. I never even got to realize what I was in the middle of, because who would have thought Spago, which became what Spago was overnight, would become that, says Silverton. What Silverton calls the floods came the minute the doors opened. Because there was only the open kitchen, she had to clear out by 4 p.m., when Ed Ledoux, the pizza maker, came in. She'd prepped days' worth of ingredients prior to opening night, but it was all gone by closing time. Things were even more discombobulated on a hot line. Of that first night, Matsusaka remembers, the timing was horrible, and nobody knew what to do. There's no system. There's no pre-opening meeting or pre-opening discussions. There was nothing. And the food started to run out. That was the craziest opening I've ever done. Mark was next to me. He was on pasta. He was making a pasta at 6. Later, he was cutting more fresh angel hair pasta. Puck was a draw, which was great for business, but a double-edged sword. Continues Matsusaka, Wolfgang was in the kitchen, so when we opened Spago, everybody came to see him. That means they're going to start talking to him. So he was on the grill. Then the food has to go out together. So Wolfgang starts talking. Nothing is coming out. So I told Mark Peel, Mark, we have to kick Wolfgang out of the kitchen. That's what we did. Because he loves to cook and he loves to talk. He has to be out of the kitchen so he can schmooze those people, talk to people, whatever he wants to do. Then we can run the kitchen a little more smoothly. It was so crazy we could not get a handle on it at all, said Puck. Famous customers denied a table, screamed at me, and said they were never going to talk to me again. If he tried to accommodate them, resulting in a wait,
then they screamed again. It was so hot.
Between Puck's Mamaison fan base and the restaurant's heat, Spago began drawing a celebrity clientele. Before long, two paparazzi were stationed like snipers along the hill that ran up from the parking lot to the restaurant.
I had just come from 5 years working in a beauty salon, says Wendy Matthews, a childhood friend of Silverton's who became an office manager at Spago. Lots of cocaine and lots of quaaludes. Lots of hip, cool young people. Everybody was sleeping with everybody. And it was sort of that same feeling at the restaurant. There were customers coming upstairs and sneaking off into the storage area to get high, and employees and people sleeping with everybody. It was that same sort of feel. It felt like being at a party all the time. I mean, even though during the day we weren't open, and it was work, but everybody was sort of having fun. You knew who was holding, who was high, who wasn't. But definitely there was a lot of substance going on, says Janice Swarman, who helped run the dining room. You couldn't get into the bathrooms. People were going two at a time, so it was either sex or drugs or both.
Swarman thinks Puck and Lazaroff were largely oblivious to it, but Lazaroff, who maintained she was an abstainer, was routinely offered coke and pot by customers, as a tip or just to share the good times. She told them owners don't accept tips, to give it to the staff at the door. Sometimes the sheer volume of self-abuse so overwhelmed her that she'd go home at the end of the night, throw open the door, and sob into the living room of the house she and Puck shared on Fifth Street.
We knew we were on this new wave, this niche of people wanting to have a place that was their own little casual playground that was exclusive in certain ways, but also inclusive. Because actually you had a lot of people who were very well known in different fields. A lot of them in entertainment, but in different fields, says Lazaroff. And some of the most powerful weren't known by other people in the restaurant, like the studio heads and whatever. I mean, the stars knew who they were, but there were loads of people. Our postman who delivered our mail would come there and dine.
Of course I can get a table. Wolfgang is a close personal friend of mine.
Richard Thornburg, William Atherton, Die Hard, 1988. All of Hollywood came to Spago, from an intergenerational mix of above-the-line names such as Michael Caine, Terry Garr, Dolly Parton, Burt Reynolds, Sylvester Stallone, and Barbra Streisand, and everybody who ever played James Bond, as one-time dining room manager Swarman puts it, to icons like Johnny Carson, to Wunderkind directors George Lucas and Steven Spielberg, and emerging industry power brokers like Mike Ovitz. Naturally, no special requests were turned down. Puck also found creative ways to flatter VIP guests, such as automatically sending them a smoked salmon and creme fraiche pizza, known colloquially to staff and guests alike as the Jewish pizza. Like the crowds, the fame just came.
All of a sudden, Entertainment Tonight was there, remembers Matthews, who transitioned into a PR role. I was getting phone calls. We want to do a segment on E.T. I didn't think, oh my God, we've hit the big time. It just sort of was.
It should, however, be remembered that Spago didn't monopolize the entertainment business. Morton's and the Ivy, to name just two popular old-school canteens, still drew bold-faced names. And Chasen's retained its popularity among the over-50 set, reinvigorated by recently elected President Ronald Reagan's fondness for it. Maybe, too, the populace was simply ready for something new. In 1981, nearly 30 years before the likes of Eataly in New York City, Jane Erickson, the punk-coiffed companion of notorious art dealer Douglas James Christmas, opened Charmer's Market, a combination open-air market and restaurant with more than 25 champagnes, under a stucco tent in Santa Monica, a stone's throw from the beach. Dustin Hoffman, Warren Beatty, Ally McGraw, and Goldie Hawn were regulars. Charmer's Bridge Nouvelle, scallops with raspberry sauce, and California, hot barbecued duck salad, cuisines, and forecast one of the defining characteristics of Spago. Dinner as entertainment, for the entertainment set.
I didn't set out to get the Hollywood crowd, Erickson told the New York Times, but I guess there's a certain atmosphere of theater here.
Lazaroff was the embodiment of Spago's theatricality. As her bank balance grew,
She began realizing those childhood fashion dreams with a loud, colorful, and unmistakable style that extended from head to toe.
"I wear twinkling clothes. Tinkerbell clothes that glisten with beads and sequins," she said. "My style is my own dream as a 5-year-old of what I'd look like when I grew up."
That 5-year-old must have also loved animals. Circling around Lazaroff like cartoon butterflies were 28 of them. Parrots, rabbits, cats, and dogs. Her wardrobe, housed in a 20-foot-long closet that she kept locked, even from Puck, comprised more than 100 dresses and more than 100 pairs of shoes. Just two examples, a purple taffeta Karl Lagerfeld mini dress with a full circle skirt, and a black bolero Rafat Ozbek suit with white passementerie. Often, she tied primitive objects into her hair and emphasized her eyes with exaggerated black eyeliner that extended the edges.
"I paint my face as if the audience were looking at me from 50 feet away," she said.
She maintained that it only took her 20 minutes to prepare such a getup, but hours to dress casually. Puck, too, flowered into fame. He was gifted at making the most demanding guests feel special. He says that because he came from a small town, where the nearest cinema was 5 kilometers away, and they had no car to get there, he didn't see movies as a kid. He didn't even own a TV. As a consequence, "I was never impressed by them," he says. "I wasn't like most of the people were if somebody was a movie star. Can we get an autograph? Because I didn't watch the movies. Most of them I never saw." When he became friendly with director Billy Wilder, "I had to lie to him, faking appreciation for his classics such as Some Like It Hot, while privately thinking, I hope he doesn't ask me who was in that." Tables were hard to come by, but in theory the restaurant was democratic, with one exception. Terai was forbidden. One night, around 1989, while Puck was in San Francisco, his maitre d' called telling him that Terai had shown up unannounced with good pal Ed McMahon.
"You know what to do," Puck told him,
and hung up.
He's way ahead of all the chefs.
In 1983, Puck and Lazaroff settled on their sophomore effort, presenting Puck's take on Chinese food. They secured a space in Santa Monica, named the restaurant after the location, Chinhua on Main. Things went more smoothly this time, though there was a hiccup when the Department of Health and Safety withheld a permit from the contractor, prompting Lazaroff to call the inspector. The problem, it was explained, was that brick is porous. The DOH didn't know who they were dealing with. Lazaroff said she'd put a polymer over it. When the inspector said the polymer would burn off, former med student Lazaroff explained that it wouldn't. Bonds strengthen when polymers are subjected to heat. When the inspector insisted she didn't know what she was talking about, Lazaroff exploded into action. She fished her old organic chemistry textbook out of the attic and went to his office early the next day, dressed for success, in a ruffled black and white dress. She insisted on seeing her tormentor, sat at his desk, and read to him out of the book in a raised voice so everybody could hear the schooling. Then she leaned in, whispering,
"Mister, if you don't sign my health plans right now, I'm going to sue you."
He stamped his approval, and Lazaroff returned to the restaurant, holding the paper aloft, triumphant once again. Chinhua on Main was another seamless Puck-Lazaroff collaboration. The kitchen turned out beef sauté with a honey chili sauce, mesquite-grilled Santa Barbara shrimp with miso, crab with black bean sauce, butter, and scallions, sole with caviar, ginger, and a vodka-spiked shrimp sauce, and, influentially, a trio of assorted crème brûlée, including ginger. Puck showed that he was no one-trick pony in the kitchen, and Lazaroff did the same with the decor. In the center of the dining room were 2 7-foot enameled brass peacocks. On the green lacquered walls was pop art. Shiny black chairs surrounded green tables. And adorning the room were gargantuan flower arrangements. Ironically, Puck had to let any Chinese cooks go.
"They couldn't cook as we wanted," he said. "They were making gooey sauces with MSG.
Any Asian cooks in the kitchen were Japanese. As an example of just how many tumblers have to fall into place for success, consider that a year before Chinhua opened, Chef Susumu Fukui
was offering a more formal combination of French and Japanese cuisine in a prescient but premature tasting menu format at La Petite Chaya in the Los Feliz neighborhood. Across town in Silver Lake, another ahead-of-his-time chef, former L'Orangerie toque Tadayoshi Matsuno, offered his version of frank Asian cuisine at Lion, a 15-seat counter-restaurant. Puck understood the importance of timing.
"There are lots of other restaurants like Spago," he said years later. "But we were first. That's probably the most important thing. It seems like there are a lot of other very talented chefs, good-looking, very articulate, but it's hard to get as well-known if you're not first."
The sentiment is echoed by a still-admiring Tarai, with whom Puck buried the hatchet after his old boss got into a tussle with throat cancer, even throwing him a 70th birthday party.
"The most important thing about Wolfgang, in my eyes, from my perspective, he's way ahead of all the chefs. He has great vision of when to change and how to adapt. And the only one that I know that has that kind of vision is Jean-Georges von Gerichten, who came to New York City in 1985. Wolfgang, for some reason, has the ability to be at the right place at the right time with the right package. And if you look at all the chefs, Joachim Splitschel, Jean-Georges, and Wolfgang, I think they're the only guys who really see the world from their perspective and are able to grow with it."
The king and queen of Hollywood dining staged themselves an appropriately regal wedding in spring 1984, a medieval ceremony at L'Hostel du Beaumanoir, where Puck began his career. Approximately 130 guests made the trip. Lazaroff produced the ultimate fantasy wedding: horse-drawn carriages, 3 costume changes, and 17 hours worth of festivities. But she couldn't escape her role as hostess. When guests complained about the accommodations, she balked,
"I'm the bride. Why do I have to deal with this?"
They had actually been married by a rabbi in a private secret ceremony in 1983. Lazaroff wanted something that belonged to them alone. And who could blame her? The Beaumanoir wedding was covered by Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. Through it all, Puck relied on Lazaroff for guidance on anything non-kitchen. Asked to cameo in a Shelley Long comedy, he deferred to her.
"Yeah, this is cute," she said, "but tell them we can write a funnier line."
The scene ended up on the cutting room floor. Before consenting to wear a suit for a Los Angeles Times Magazine cover story, he had to gain Lazaroff's approval. Lazaroff didn't resent Puck's fame, but it peeved her to no end that her contribution was often overlooked. Lazaroff wanted credit for everything she did, which should have been news to nobody. The copyright page of Modern French Cooking for the American Kitchen features this note: introductory material written in collaboration with Barbara Lazaroff.
"When it started to take off at Spago, probably in the second year, and Wolfgang got so in demand and everybody wanted him for a different event and travel and to do different charities and stuff, there came a point where Barbara came to me and said that I had to run everything by her as well, before I could just go to Wolfgang and get an okay," says Matthews. "I think that part of it was that Barbara was a partner in it, and nobody really considered her. Wolf was in the forefront. He was the chef. He was charming. He had this personality. People really didn't know what Barbara's place was there. I know that everybody looks at me like I'm a publicity-hungry society climber," she said. "But the one thing I will not do is all the work on something and have somebody stick their name on it, even if it is my husband."
Though they filed for divorce in 2002, Wolfgang Puck's corporate website features a biography of Lazaroff on the Our Team page, naming her as co-founder, and she still spends time at Spago Beverly Hills. Eventually, Lazaroff couldn't take it anymore and began writing letters to reporters who felt she didn't properly credit her in print. Just as Puck had kicked her under the table in that publishing meeting, he worried that she'd alienate the media and their life-giving ink. Says Reichel,
"Wolf used to call me and say, 'Please make sure you get Barbara's name in when you do this story, or it's not going to be worth going home.'"
When uniforms were being produced for Chinois on Main, Lazaroff had the manufacturer create a jacket for her that had a message embroidered on the back: "I'm not Wolfgang Puck's girlfriend. He's my boyfriend."
"We had a major disagreement," said Lazaroff. and we finally fought it out. I said, look, Wolf, you do what you have to do. This is what I need to do. I would rather have somebody say she's bitchy, she's this and that.
Her contributions to the restaurants might have been the least of it, and the true source of her ire. Ventured one reporter, Lazaroff's most ambitious undertaking has been the making of Wolfgang Puck. One Halloween, Lazaroff made a Batman villain of herself, naming her costume I Am Woman, a black dress to which she sewed my animals, a washboard, models of the restaurants and a drafting board, hammers, nails, cooking utensils, financial papers. All this shit was hanging off me. I wore a big crown and these black gloves that said, sister, mother, daughter, wife, sex kitten. That is what I feel like all the time.
While Puck and Lazaroff were still living out their dizzying success, a New York Times rundown of L.A. restaurants reported the Sunset Boulevard, worthy decline of Ma Maison.
Now the astroturf carpeting is frayed, the flowers are wilted, and the service creaks, wrote Marion Burroughs. Without Mr. Puck, Ma Maison is living on its past.
It didn't help that in 1982, when Ma Maison's new chef, John Sweeney, was accused of murdering actress Dominique Dunn, daughter of writer Dominic Dunn, many believed Terai stood by Sweeney, even enlisted legal counsel for him. In his book, A Taste of Hollywood, Terai insists that he merely asked a friend in the public defender's office to make sure he had a good lawyer, and has had no further contact with the man since. Terai writes that it was one of the most stressful periods of his life, and no doubt cost him customers. Whatever the reason, Ma Maison closed for good in 1985. The divorce metaphor comes up often in the recounting of industry breakups, and as with The Real Thing, it's the children, in this case the restaurants, who suffer the most.
2. The Auto Syndrome. The fact that you were doing it for the public was something of an afterthought. Karen Puro, formerly Pritzker. The story of how an anonymous chef tweaked the New York City food establishment while becoming a folk hero to young cooks on the East Coast. And a constellation of American restaurant couples went their own way, with mixed success and longevity, in and out of the kitchen. 6 weeks into 1979, about the same time Michael McCarty was putting the finishing touches on his nascent masterpiece On the Other Side of the Republic, a mythic figure rose over the Eastern culinary landscape. His name was Otto, and he was a chef unlike any other. First, because he wasn't French, but that was the least of it. He favored T-shirts to starched whites, owned his own restaurant in partnership and collaboration with his wife, and toiled in bucolic bliss in the countryside beyond New York City, where he kept a small garden and a trout pond, and whipped up a broad range of eclectic offerings that changed daily and so spontaneously that he couldn't dream of scribbling the menu before 3 o'clock in the afternoon. He was also a mystery, a puzzle. Otto wasn't his real name, but a pseudonym dreamed up by the New Yorker magazine's writer John McPhee, who introduced him to the world in a sprawling 25,000-word profile in the magazine's February 19 issue. The article spun the tale of how Otto, with wife Anne, also a pseudonym, serving as pastry chef, sommelier, and hostess, ran a 55-seat country restaurant in a rustic farmhouse inn where the author claimed, audaciously, to have eaten the 20 or 30 best meals of his life, despite the fact that he dined in the fields of Les Baux and the streets of Lyon. Sly references to, respectively, chefs Raymond Thuillet and Paul Bocuse. McPhee, known for his extravagantly detailed reporting, he had written a definitive piece on green markets for the magazine the year prior, stuffed the article so full of minutiae that Otto all but sprang to life and walked off the page. He was a man of mixed Austrian and British extraction who spent his life in utter servitude to his restaurant, poring over cookery books and scavenging for ingredients everywhere from Manhattan markets to his local Grand Union. He began his day at 6 a.m., prepped until the dinner hour, then cooked from an open kitchen for his customers, who might range in number from as few as 2 to a little more than 40, The chef shopped from local groceries and supermarkets and had, according to McPhee, developed a repertoire of about 600 appetizers and entrees, main courses, of his own devising. Things like veal and shrimp quenelles, sautéed scallops with pesto, paella a la marinara, and a signature dish he dubbed chicken coriander, chicken breasts marinated in yogurt with lemon juice and cilantro. Even when he went classic, he broke with French convention, making bordelaise with boiled pork rinds instead of marrow, bernaise with green peppercorns rather than black. This was no small matter. Most chefs still adhered to Escoffier. Recall those asterisks on Ken Frank's early menu denoting his unique dishes. To do otherwise was an act of rebellion. McPhee's story was titled Brigade de Cuisine, an arch nod to the fact that there was no brigade. Otto worked alone. "There is no way to get qualified help," lamented subject to biographer. "You'd have to import kids from Switzerland." The article boasts many such markers of the culinary times, such as Otto's observation that when you can buy bean curd and egg roll wrappers in a supermarket in a town like this, there's some sort of quiet revolution going on. Decades before the term food porn would come into vogue, before a series such as The Mind of a Chef would dissect generations yet unborn, Brigade de Cuisine trafficked in what might be termed chef porn. McPhee relates Otto's every step and sentiment, leaving nothing but his name to the imagination. The lingering journalistic lens produces a gauzy, slow-mo literary effect. He devotes an entire paragraph to a day in the life of Otto's kitchen towel and five columns to a Manhattan shopping expedition, laced with Otto's ruminations on everything from ingredients, chorizo, lobster, sea urchins, to the most rudimentary of equipment, whisks. Readers found themselves parked in Otto's restaurant galley as he crafted new dishes, observing him in his home, where he packed school lunches for his children. They were even introduced to his customers, a utopian and eclectic lot that included a bridge toll collector, a plumber, a state senator from another state, and an international tennis star, left tantalizingly unnamed. McPhee also reported that the center of attention and the subject of a good deal of table talk is the unseen man in the kitchen. The customers present as groupies, as they relate, in rapt terms, their admiration of him and his skills, in language usually reserved for artists and musicians. As if that weren't enough, Otto, in the piece that catapulted him to a sort of postmodern fame, expresses his distrust of the limelight. "He prefers being a person to being a personality," writes McPhee. "His wish to be acknowledged is exceeded by his wish not to be celebrated, and he could savor recognition only if he could have it without publicity." So, per McPhee, he deserved attention commensurate with the kings of Nouvelle Cuisine, but was too modest to covet it. He was, in other words, perfect. The issue landed like a hand grenade. Otto, in part because of his anonymity, in part because of McPhee's rhapsodic appraisal, was an overnight sensation, and a one-man generational demarcation line, received differently by two very different populations. The larger, more entrenched, more vociferous of them, the culinary establishment, wasn't nearly as taken by Otto as the author was. No sooner had the piece hit newsstands than it was, in New Yorker parlance, the talk of the town. In hindsight, it was perfectly engineered to be that. McPhee opened with a bang, putting his best meals of my life claim in the first paragraphs, and compounded the mystique by not divulging the restaurant's location, only teasing that it was more than 5 miles and less than 100 from the triangle formed by Le Grenou, Le Tess, and Le Cine, three of the most celebrated French restaurants of the day. Some muckety-mucks granted the unknown toque the benefit of the doubt. "His range is fabulous, and his ideas are awfully good too," said Joe Baum. But most industry honchos and media bigs treated him as a curiosity, possibly even a fraud. The New Yorker's editor William Shawn had inadvertently softened Brigade de Cuisine up for attack when, in an unprecedented break with the magazine's policy, he allowed McPhee to perform his own fact-checking in order to preserve Otto's identity. Nonetheless, the magazine's offices were inundated by calls seeking the truth behind Otto, spurring an internal guessing game. Some industrious staffers, long before the conveniences of Google, researched the woodland critters name-dropped in the story, hoping to discover that one of them thrived in a particular locality. The fact-checking anomaly sparked accusations that Otto was pure fiction, or a composite of multiple chefs, but the author's sterling reputation denied those any oxygen. Still, there was no shortage of criticism. Four Seasons co-owner Tom Margadi balked that Otto wasn't in the restaurant business, really. He's an eccentric doing his own thing. One observer, former Culinary Institute of America president Jacob Rosenthal, suggested the piece was a gambit by The New Yorker to make up for lost ground in the restaurant coverage war with New York Magazine, where critic Gail Green, an early proponent of Nouvelle Cuisine, whose sensual reviews and articles, she also wrote erotica, were tailor-made for the emerging times, was making waves. Reporting at the time only hinted at the anti-French sentiment woven into Brigade du Cuisine, and whether Francophilia might therefore have motivated the article's detractors. As if Otto's not being French and McPhee's claiming that his food lapped France's best weren't bad enough, in the piece, Otto refers to the most celebrated New York City French restaurants derisively as frog ponds, bristles at the snobbery of the captains in their dining rooms, reveals that he once found ice crystals in his meat at the well-respected La Caravelle. There's also no question that, whether intentional or not, McPhee's claim that his meals at Otto's were superior to those he'd enjoyed in the Nouvelle Cuisine temples of Le Beau and Lyon casually called into question the palates and knowledge of the city's reigning tastemakers. Then there was the handful of words buried in the piece in which Otto, dining with McPhee at Lutèce, the absolute pinnacle of French food in New York, if not the country at the time, deduces that the turbot they are eating must have been purchased, wait for it, frozen.
"Why should the story be taken seriously?" asked Raymond Sokolov, former food editor of the New York Times. "Why should we accept McPhee's reaction to food and an unknown, unnamed chef criticizing the fish at Lutèce?"
Mimi Sheraton, the New York Times restaurant critic from 1975 through 1983, believes that effrontery might have provoked some of the attacks on Otto.
"I think that's partly true, and especially in the food world," she says. "Food writers love Lutèce. I don't think it bothered me any more than the fact that he was taken around to all kinds of restaurants and critiqued them," to McPhee during the writing of the piece. "I minded that whole part of it. Something about that rankled me. Craig Claiborne and Frank Priel, the Times wine critic, and I all thought it was bullshit. Craig, of course, on the part of Lutèce, because he was even closer to André Soltner than I was. They didn't think it sounded that good."
The gentlemanly Soltner declined to criticize Otto, but chafed at the notion that he served frozen fish. The Lord of Lutèce fired off a mailgram to The New Yorker, offering to produce 10 years' worth of ichthyologic receipts and demanding an apology. After a week of Otto-mania, the establishment smackdown came from Priel and Sheraton herself, who'd had no plans to cover him until the paper's managing editor, Al Siegel, sent them individual notes that read, "I hope you guys are looking for this guy."
"Oh, shit," Sheraton recalls thinking. "Let's find him." And in 3 days, we did.
The writers dispatched a stringer to out Otto, and they ID'd him as Alan Lieb of the Bullhead Inn in Shohola, Pennsylvania, and prior to that, through November 1978, of the Red Fox Inn in Milford, Pennsylvania. The clever sleuth poked around political circles, leading to a Pike County Republican poll, who happened to be president of the bank, that gave Lieb and wife Anna Rosmarja, nicknamed Ronnie, their mortgage. Sheraton, Priel, and Priel's wife made a pilgrimage to the Bullhead Inn. Sheraton was unimpressed. She still is. As I sat with her in the living room of her Greenwich Village house nearly 4 decades later, she scrunched up her face and said,
"The food was really bad. I still remember a something filled with something that was all wet bread. I have in my mind a vision of a lump of wet bread."
On February 26, 1979, just 2 weeks after the Otto feeding frenzy began, Sheraton detailed the trio's disappointment in a piece headlined, "Dinner at the Elusive Otto's, The Disappointing Details." What's striking is how personal the takedown seems, The Sheraton turns Leib's own words, as quoted in Brigade du Cuisine, against him. In McPhee's piece, Leib rails against canned foods. Sheraton describes the artichokes he serves as having pale yellow, bottoms of the type usually canned. She also echoes the Lutèce slight. The block shape of the duck and the precision of the straight cut through the breastbone hinted that the duck might have been purchased frozen. Ironically, given the fact-checking scandal attached to Brigade du Cuisine, the Times verifier let one detail slip. Leib's first name is printed as A-L-L-E-N, when it was in fact spelled A-L-A-N.
While it is true that one cannot make a definitive evaluation of any restaurant on the basis of a single meal, Sheraton concluded, it is equally true that there is a minimal level of quality below which a great and experienced cook cannot sink even on his worst day.
This criticism would sting today. At a time when the New York Times' power was absolute, it was devastating.
I have a little roadhouse in which I try to cook fairly good food, Leib said that March. That review was like dropping a hydrogen bomb on a small island.
Adding to the melodrama, McPhee was tipped off to the impending unmasking and phoned Sheraton at home around midnight, the very evening she dined at the Bullhead Inn, to entreat her not to out the chef. When Sheraton returned the call around 4 the next morning, things got heated.
I said, "You know how hot a topic food is? You know how hot a topic restaurants are? Do you think you could write that in the New Yorker with all the signposts? It was like a scavenger hunt."
Then she informed him the point was moot. Unbeknownst to McPhee, an initial appraisal had been phoned into the Times by Priel from a roadside phone booth and was in that morning's paper. Sheraton's longer piece ran 2 days later. The ensuing crossfire was worthy of a Quentin Tarantino shootout, as many of Sheraton's fellow writers publicly criticized her decision. Around the same time, Village Voice photographer Fred McDara sold a picture of her to Newsweek, depriving her of her anonymity, which she believes might have been retaliation for her exposé. As New York Post gossip columnist Cindy Adams used to sign off, "Only in New York, kids."
"I guess the press can't stand a vacuum," concluded Leib. "This time the vacuum was me."
You don't have to break into that triangle.
Chefs and the journalists who cover them live in surprisingly different worlds. For all the offense Brigade du Cuisine caused to a subset of young Americans considering a life of chefdom, Otto was an instant folk hero and North Star. The same temerity that offended the establishment bolstered them, showed them what was possible, and perhaps because Otto's true identity was initially unknown, allowed them to imagine themselves tracing his footsteps. They no doubt also related to his off-the-grid anonymity, since none of them would have been sought out to opine in the flurry of Otto stories. They were the rebels waiting to spring on the public. David Lederman, who with his wife Susan would open Manhattan Market the same year the piece ran, and would go on to strike gold with his business David's Cookies, calls it, "Probably the best food article I ever read in my life. It was seminal to the food movement in the United States." Like many who came up at this disconnected time, when Lederman speaks of the United States, he means his corner of it, just as when some refer to the California food revolution, they omit contemporaneous goings-on across the rest of the country.
"Everybody wanted to be Otto," says Lederman. "Everybody wanted to cook like Otto, have the repertoire of Otto. This is when there were not a lot of people cooking. Otto was self-taught. He was a genius cook, according to John McPhee. He had impeccable technique. He totally freestyled, which at the time was totally new. This guy had total freedom to cook whatever he wanted to cook with no rules. He was an absolute artist."
"It was everything that I was dreaming of," says Peter Hoffman, who was then cooking at Le Colombe d'Or, a Provençal bistro owned by George and Helen Studley in New York City, and would go on to open the Soho mainstay Savoy.
"Here was a guy who was writing a daily menu, working off of what was available to him, improvisationally, living out in the country. His wife was the pastry chef. It was a beautiful fortune, and I completely loved it. It was like, you don't have to break into that triangle," says Hoffman.
referring to the trio of French restaurants name-dropped in the article. Hoffman so related to Lieb that when Sheridan unmasked him,
I was like, I'm going. I went with my girlfriend at the time, and we spent the weekend out there. I was there to make a pilgrimage. I wanted to see the trout pond in the back, and I wanted to walk the grounds.
Hoffman's Bullhead Inn experience counterbalanced Sheraton's. It was, he says, very good. Not perfect. It was still incredibly exciting and creative and well executed. It was a menu that wasn't trying to be traditionally French at that point in any way. 38 years later, Hoffman still remembers the meal starting with a risotto ball with molten cheese in the center and thinking, they aren't going to have that at Lutèce. Not all young American cooks loved Otto. Bob Pritzker, who with his wife Karen would open Dodin Buffon in New York City, also in 1979, found it all very suspect. The production by two people of food which seemed intricate, and smoked in the house and ground in the house, and shopped for inefficiently at Grand Union. It's not real. You don't conduct a restaurant that way and hope to come out the other end whole, financially or mentally, he says. Nonetheless, when Google coughed up a phone number for Pritzker and I cold called him for an interview for this book, he chuckled, then asked me if I'd ever read McPhee's piece, a printout of which was spread before me on my desk. It seems I had caught Pritzker precisely at a moment when he was remembering it, nearly 4 decades after the fact. Alan Lieb has long since faded from the spotlight, but for those he touched, Otto still looms large.
American food, as I saw it, was as much about who was in my kitchen as anything else. We'd start with a southern dish, fried chicken or pan-blackened fish, which Abel would perfect. Wasabe would take it over, adding a daikon or seaweed salad. Valentine would add a package of rice wrapped in banana. Together we made an amalgam that was as American as shoofly pie.
Karen Hubert Allison. How I Gave My Heart to the Restaurant Business, a novel.
You were living in your own little world.
In a quirk of timing on par with the Jane Fonda, Michael Douglas nuclear cautionary film, The China Syndrome, being released, coincidentally, in March 1979, just 2 weeks prior to the Three Mile Island accident, Brigade du Cuisine reflected and predicted a very particular species of chef evolving throughout the Northeast around this time. Before 1979 drew to a close, 5 American couples would open restaurants in the Otto and Anne, or Alan and Anna, mode. Only, they would do it right in New York City. They were, in order of opening in New York, Bob and Karen Pritzker's Dodin Buffon, Len Allison and Karen Hubert's Hubert's, Barry and Susan Wine's The Quilted Giraffe, David and Susan Lederman's Manhattan Market, and David and Karen Waltuck's Chanterelle. It was also the year that another couple, Tim and Nina Zagat, who had met working in Paris, started a New York restaurant survey among friends that would lead, 3 years later, to the first of their slender burgundy-hued publications that would be updated annually, and then appear in other cities and eventually online. And another couple, Britt Keith McNally, who would go on to build the restaurant empire founded on Balthazar and other classics, and Lynn Wagenknecht, whom he would marry, then divorce, opened the stylish bistro The Odeon in Tribeca the following year, in tandem with McNally's brother, Brian. The restaurant launched the career of one of the few prominent African-American chefs of the 1980s, Patrick Clark, a cook's son from Brooklyn, who had trained under Michel Girard, and fashioned a menu that fused French finesse and American must-haves like burgers, in a retro, casual setting trumpeted by a neon sign that became an iconic image of the 1980s. The restaurants were far from clones, but had much in common, especially considering the paucity of American chefs at the time, and the relatively small number of standout restaurants, most of them French, in New York City. All were operated by couples who were also owners. Most of the couples had, at most, limited formal training, and learned or sharpened their cooking and hospitality chops on the job, and they favored or aspired to a nouvelle style over traditional French cuisine. Yet another couple, Sally and John Darr, opened La Tulipe in the West Village that same year with a gender reversal. Sally was the chef and John, who left academia for the restaurant, the multitasking partner. But the restaurant served classic cuisine. Nevertheless, by the time she got around to reviewing La Tulipe in 1980, New York Magazine's restaurant critic Gail Green, connecting Sally Darr to the trend, fretted that she might have been another victim of the auto syndrome. Two of the restaurants gestated outside New York City well before 1979. Dodin Buffon, which opened at 405 East 58th Street, just weeks before auto was introduced to the masses, began life in Boston in 1974, a labor of love by Karen and Bob Pritzker. And the Quilted Giraffe debuted in New Paltz, New York, in 1975, strictly as a business venture by the Wines. All of the restaurants had been conceived before auto was introduced to the world, but they were all of a piece with McPhee's subject, showcases for a very specific subspecies of American chef, when American chef was scarcely a species to begin with. The restaurants also represented some of the first attempts by young Americans to interpret the nouvelle cuisine sensibility in the United States, a reflection of their open-mindedness and of the breakaway barrier to entry. The idea that couples with scant, if any, formal training could even contemplate becoming chefs and restaurateurs in Manhattan would be laughable today. But at the time, it was a reasonable enough prospect that several successfully attempted it.
It was a very happy time, says Josh Wesson, who briefly served as sommelier at the Quilted Giraffe, then filled the same role for about 3 years at Hubert's. There was a group of like-minded individuals who were all doing different things but had a kind of shared vision when it came to experimenting, innovating, playing with different culinary traditions and different techniques, and creating things that were uniquely theirs. The first wave of nouvelle cuisine had broken over the shores of the States, so there were techniques and an appreciation of freshness and lightness, informed as much by Japan as it was France. But the directions that each of those couples took were quite different. Of the restaurants, three proved short-lived, and two endured to help define the ensuing decades in New York City dining. The first of the short-lived duets was Dodin Buffon, the love child of Karen Ney Cooperman and Bob Pritzker, who were, respectively, an advertising copywriter and an attorney by trade, though Bob never got around to actually practicing. When they met, he was working for Hotel Corporation of America. Three of these couples' husbands were law school grads, and two never practiced, demonstrating both the force of conventional career paths and how strong and sudden was the kitchen's lure. Bob was a native of Providence, Rhode Island, who grew up in Pawtucket. Karen was from Westchester County, New York. In Boston, sometime around 1969, he spotted her, a Boston University student at the time, and went right for her. They fell in love, and his enthusiasm for food and cooking swept her away in its undertow. Julia Child was an abstraction to most Americans, but to the Pritzkers, she was a very real, local presence. Julia Child had come back from France and moved to Cambridge, and was the doyenne, suddenly, of food, says Bob. Right there in Boston, this shithole of a microcosm for food, except for the fish, perhaps. The Boston food scene in the early 1970s was minuscule. Karen remembers it as Child, cooking instructor Madeline Kamen, French restaurant Maison Robert, and nothing else. Jack Savinor, Julia Child's go-to butcher, was a hub for local food nascenti. A bit of the glue, says Bob, and the Pritzkers hung around his shop, networked. There was a lot of fanaticism at that counter, a lot of intensity, remembers Bob. I'd never seen anything like it. Years before Julie and Julia author Julie Powell conquered the internet doing the same in a blog that led to the book, the Pritzkers cooked their way through Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking, Volumes 1 and 2, and also leaned heavily on Richard Olney.
I don't think there were that many books that were written clearly enough for people who weren't formally trained, says Karen.
They bought their meats from Savinor, their fish from Legal Seafood's George Berkowitz, and produced so much food in their low-rent Back Bay apartment, prepping on a half-collapsed ping-pong table, that they gave most of it away to neighbors.
And just like that, they were cooks.
It must have been a feeling within some of us that what we were doing in our lives wasn't particularly satisfying,
says Karen of the Zeitgeist,
that we were doing what we were programmed